Session number 1196, Real 5.
Captain Henderson, Real 5. We were talking about the conditions at Hooge, which we were in, largely speaking, May, June, July. That's sort of May and June, mainly. During the daily routine, which we were talking about, as a Lance Corporal, which you were then, would you have any responsibilities during the day that you had to discharge?
Oh, yes, yes. There were various things that the company commander used to come round and say, we've heard this, or we've heard that. I want you to keep a special lookout on that particular part.
And you'd pass that on to the sentries, would you?
That's right. And sometimes you were told they had proof that the Germans could hear what you said if you spoke too loud. And therefore we had to tell everybody at that corner, keep it low.
How would they know that? Do you know how they'd know?
Oh, they had machines. They used to stick various things in the trench. I wasn't aware of what they called them, but they could get sensors to find out whether the Germans could hear us or we could hear them.
So that was one side. What other jobs would you have as Lance Corporal? That's to do with what the Germans were doing and telling the people to watch out or be quiet.
Yes,
what other jobs would you have as Lance Corporal?
As a Lance Corporal, you went round and I collected any letters that were their lads had written, and you would gather them up and have them ready for the quartermaster sergeant, handing you the rations in the dark at night time and handing the letters for posting.
The men would write letters in the front line then?
Oh, yes, oh, yes. Most chaps, of course, use the field postcard a lot. But that was only to assure their relatives that they were still alive and this sort of thing.
What, any other jobs you had to do as Lance Corporal?
Yes. As a Lance Corporal, you would have to see that if you are handed a packet of tea or something like that for four, well, you saw that it was divided up for four. And a tin of bully beef for six, you saw the bully beef.
So you helped supervise fair shares of rations?
Oh, fair shares, that's right, yes. Give out any letters that came after the rations, and jobs like that. And then, of course, the captain, or his second in command, was always inquiring, is everybody well, Henderson? You know, let us know if anybody doesn't feel quite well or things like that.
So you monitored the state of the men in your section?
Oh, yes, oh, yes.
And were the men all right?
What's that?
Were the men all right? Were the men in your section, largely speaking, all right?
Oh, yes, yes. It was rather strange. That was one thing I hardly ever understood in the trenches. After all the muck and all the stuff that was thrown at us and whatnot, you could still march them out and they'd the next morning be as cheery as him. Remarkable.
So that's any other duties you had as Lance Corporal you can put?
No, I think that's about a lot. Besides, you had to take your position as a sentry and...
You were still on sentry duty then?
Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes.
So would you supervise the sentry rota, or would the sergeant do that, the NCO?
Oh, the sergeant would do that,
You were, it was sort of, your job was mainly on the minor level of NCO?
Yeah, that's right, to see that things were done, that should be done.
And what would the sergeants supervise in the trenches? What was their job in the trench?
Oh, well, no, mainly arms. The sergeants were the people who saw that machine guns, rifles, bayonets, etc. were properly kept. And they would have an inspection every day nearly.
And was it difficult to keep your rifle proper, in a good condition in the trench?
You no, said it was I don't think it wasn't a difficult proposition as long as you paid attention to things and did what they told you to do.
And what did you have to do to keep your rifle in good condition? I mean, there's mud and stuff that go down the barrel.
You used to have a pull-through. The first thing about a rifle is to see that the barrel is clean. And the first thing you did in the morning when you had nothing else to do, you had a pull-through to clean the rifle barrel. Then after that, examine the escape mechanism and see if...
Firing mechanism, you mean?
The firing mechanism, and just see if all the points are working. Keep the bayonet clean. Most lads did this automatically, of course. They wanted to be sure that they could actually use what they were having to hug about all day.
So that the sergeants would inspect that. Would they also monitor set the sentry rotor and make sure all the sentries were on it?
Oh, yes. That was one thing that they were very keen about. If things went wrong there, there was always what we called hell to play.
And that was the sergeant's job, or was it
the officer's job? Yes, yes.
Or was it the officer's job?
Well, the officer was there to supervise everything. I should imagine the officer was aware of rifles, sentry duty, food, everything. He just kept sort of a panoramic activity of looking after.
So it was like the junior NCOs, the Lance Corporals, perhaps the Corporals, would look after the ration issue, the post.
Yes, that's right.
The sergeants looked after the weapons and the sentry rotor, and the officers just made sure that everything was running.
That's right, yes.
Is that right, though? I mean,
That's right, yeah.
So did the sergeants live in the front line with you at Hooge?
Oh, yes, and the officers, oh, yes.
Were the officers actually in the front line, or would they be back in a dugout?
Oh, no, they were in the front line.
So did the officers get the same conditions as you did at that time?
Absolutely. Yes, there was no reserve bungalows or anything behind the lines for officers. They were in the trenches and they had dugouts.
But you said you didn't have dugouts in the front line at Hooge. If you see what I mean. You said you had no dugouts at Hooge. So would the officers have...
Well, the dugouts at Hooge were not in the front line, but they were in the support line immediately behind them.
And that's where the officers would live?
That's right. Oh, yes.
So they had slightly better conditions in that they had a dugout?
Yes, and they had slightly better conditions because the quartermaster sergeants were able to buy what the officers wanted, whereas the ordinary Tommy just depended upon his army rations.
Did they have servants also in your battalion?
Oh, yes, I had the servants, yes, oh, yes.
So they had a more comfortable life, but not that much more comfortable. Is that what you...
They were living under the geometric conditions, the climate and this sort of thing, but they were having a cup of tea made for them, and they were having a lunch prepared for them, and they had somebody to wash up their cups and saucers and this sort of thing. Someone to take off their jacket in the evening and brush down and whatnot.
And they had a dugout?
Oh, yeah, and they had a dugout, yes.
Was there any jealousy amongst the men about the officers having slightly better conditions than they did?
No, I should say on the whole. Of course, the world thought differently in those days, compared with what the world thinks of various grades of society today, and the officers were treated with respect. The men, of course, eventually found that they were depending upon the officers to be led properly and given all the safety that they could get. And I don't think I ever found any feeling or any stated against the officers. The men knew who they were. We fortunately were lucky that we had local men, local officers, all engaged in business and work in Northumberland and Durham, No, I should imagine that there was no any umbrage about the officers, no.
Were they popular? You say they were respected, but were they popular as well?
Oh, yes, yes. I should say that the officers of the Northumbrian Brigade were revered, if anything. They were local people, and the men had a great attachment for them.
So, during the day, would you do any... Would any jobs be carried out, like strengthening the trenches, or just, you know...
Oh, yes. That was one job that was continuously being attended to. If there was any likelihood of a breakdown in the trenches with the ramparts or anything like that, they were attended to immediately.
Were they using revetting of any sort at Hooge?
No. No,
Was just a mud wall.
Yeah, that's right. At Hooge, the trenches were so near that you couldn't undertake any sort of work like that. They would hear you, they would see you. It was only in parts like the Messines, say, where the trenches were a mile away, probably, that you could do anything that you wanted to do.
Was there anything else you'd be doing during the day that you can remember?
No. I think mainly, we just mentioned that the water supply was looked at to see if we could possibly get any more water than we had. Things like that. We're always striving to get something that might be obtained, you know.
Now, during the night, the sentry rota would carry on all through the night. When would you tend to sleep? Would you sleep during the day or during the night in a rough sector like Hooge, or would you not get much sleep at all? I mean,
even during the day, if you weren't on duty, if you weren't a sentry, you could have a snooze in the trenches if you could get a sit down and this sort of thing.
And where would you actually sleep?
Well, I should... it went round the clock. You can't say in the Hooge trenches that we had a particular part of the day or night for sleeping.
But where would you sleep? Sorry.
Oh, in the trenches themselves. Or in the dugouts. You had to make things do. And I was quite happy sitting on a sort of a little platform in the front line and getting a bit snooze.
Now, during the night, would there be any working parties at Hooge, or would this be impossible because of the noise during the night?
There'd be one or two parties, working parties, or there would be certain people out on patrol in between the lines. Not at Hooge, of course. But in the ordinary trenches, you sent three men out to listen to the Germans during the night and this sort of thing. But at Hooge, no.
Now, you said a bit earlier that the gap between the lines was largely filled with barbed wire.
Yes, that's right. That's Hooge, yes.
Would you send wiring parties out to add to it or make sure it was still intact?
Oh, yes. The wiring parties were part of the night employment. Going out to see what had happened, had it been split by bombardment, or if there'd been a bit bombarded.
And that would happen at Hooge?
At Hooge? Oh, we didn't have much wiring party there.
So the wire was just there?
Was just there, and you had to accept it.
Now, it's Hooge, all these things, reconnaissance patrols, fighting patrols, raiding, all that didn't happen.
No. You are in Hooge, and Hooge was a part of the line that didn't lend itself to trying to finesse with things.
Was there much artillery fire at Hooge, or were you in the front line, or were you too close to Germans to get the artillery fire on you, German artillery fire?
Yeah. Well, of course, I should imagine it was a problem for them as well as it was for us, because you had to be right on spot if you weren't going to kill some of your own men.
So did they fire?
Eh?
Did they fire?
Oh, they had an occasional when they, if they think they thought something, they would send two or three shots over, you know. But as far as continuous bombardment at Hooge, no.
So it's an occasional shell?
Yes, just occasional.
And normally shell. If they'd seen some sign of activity, either smoke...
That's right, yes, yeah.
Did you know which type of... Could you recognise the difference? You were fairly new still at Hooge.
Yeah.
Could you recognise the differences between shells then, or were they just shells at that stage?
Well, just shells, that's all.
Now, did you get... had they brought in mortars then, Minenwerfers?
No. I can't remember ever having trench machines at Hooge.
On either side?
On either side.
Well, so... Was sniping a problem at Hooge?
Oh, yes, that you had to be careful. The sniping was, there was quite a lot of sniping.
On both sides?
Both sides, yes.
Who did the sniping on the British side? Was it special people, or was it just when you fancied a shot yourself?
We had what we call people that you could ask to come up and have a shot or two because you'd seen something.
Now, would that be a battalion sniper or a company sniper?
Oh, company sniper.
And how many of them were there to a company?
Oh, well, no. I should say none. It was unofficial.
So there was just somebody you knew was a good shot
good
and
shot,
a sniper?
That's right. And they were known to the corporals and the sergeants.
So it was entirely unofficial?
It was a part of the war, and it was carried out when it could be carried out.
Now, you were a good shot. Were you ever tempted to do any sniping?
Oh, I sniped in my day.
Did you snipe at Hooge?
No, I don't think so. Well, I was busy then making what they call rifle batteries.
What was a rifle battery?
A rifle battery was a series of a dozen rifles put into clips and made the fire simultaneously. And the first one I succeeded in getting was in the line further down after we moved from Hooge. And I had it put on a stand, you know. The Germans couldn't see it, but we were satisfied that they were using a church in the distance as a lookout. And I was quite happy about that.
I'll probably come back to that as well. So, you didn't do much sniping. Was there much general small arms fire at Hooge? You said it was a hot spot. Was there a lot of firing going on?
Oh, yes. They used to come in spasms. It was like nerves, human nerves. There were certain times when we thought they wanted a pounding, and there were certain times when the Germans thought they would give us a pounding, you know. And it carried on for about half an hour, then died away.
And that was just the ordinary infantry shooting?
Shooting for shooting's sake, to let them see that they were there.
Would you be aiming? Did you do this?
Oh, yes.
Would you aim, or would you just stick the rifle up and fire it?
Oh, we tried for their trenches, the top of their trenches, you know. You couldn't see them. But it was to let them know that we were still there and capable of meeting their fire.
Now, was there a lot of hand grenades, bombing?
Oh, at Hooge, yes. Now, that was the chief bugbear of Hooge.
So that was far worse than the machine guns, the sniping,
oh,
and the artillery.
Oh, yes. The trenches, as I say, were at some parts 15 yards away. And one could easily throw bombs. And that was the bugbear of being in Hooge that made it a place that nobody wanted to be.
Now, what type of bombs were they using, the Germans?
Well, all I can say is they were hand grenades.
But were they the stick bomb at that stage, with a stick on the back?
Oh, some bombs had a stick on the back. You could throw them further, of course, with a stick on the back than you could with through your hands. But I should say the main bombs at Hooge were hand grenades.
And what sort of hand grenades were you using? Because And the Mills wouldn't have come out by then, would it?
The what?
The Mills bomb wouldn't have come out
by then.
So what type were you using, or do you not remember?
No, just a moment. I can't recall the name of those bombs, though.
You don't remember which sort, but that's fine.
I know, you pulled the pin out and...
That would be the Mills, though.
Mills bomb, yes.
But did you have them at Hooge? It sounds a little early.
No, we hadn't had those at Hooge. We didn't have those at Hooge.
So it was an earlier type, but you don't remember
which. Earlier type, yes. And not so good as the Mills bomb.
And what sort of defence did you have against bombs? I mean, did you try and do anything to sort of stop the German bombs having effect?
There was no defence against hand grenades. No defence at all. You couldn't put a top on your trench. You couldn't do this, that and the other. And remember, it was quite a while after we got to France that we got tin hats.
So what would you do when you saw a bomb? Would you see the bombs coming?
Oh, yes, you could see the bombs mainly coming, and you would just run and get behind a bay, the next bay, you see. And the bomb could come over and explode and never touched anybody.
When a bomb landed in the trench, was there any means of muffling it?
No. One never attempted to muffle it. Oh, no. You were either there or you weren't there.
You just ran.
That's right. Yeah.
What sort? How powerful were the bombs?
Oh, I should say 10 yards.
If you were 10 yards from a bomb, you were in trouble then.
If you were in the circle, you're in trouble. You see, 10-yard diameter circle. I should imagine that would be a fair estimate.
And so, did they cause a lot of casualties?
Oh, yes. The main thing about bombs was to cause a lot of casualties with a lot of wounds. You know, hitting chaps, making a mess of their arms and legs and this sort of thing. Whereas a rifle bullet went through you, a bomb sort of broke into all sorts of pieces and you were hit in umpteen places.
Did people try and throw them back, or was that sort of bravado?
Oh no. That you'd never get anybody picking a bomb up and trying to throw it back. No.
Now, what about... One of the things that had happened on the day you landed in France was the German gas attack.
Yes.
What gas precautions had been introduced, and how scared were you all of gas? Because people often... It was a very big thing, the introduction.
Yes, well, we knew that when we landed in the Ypres salient, especially at Hooge, the order was to take off one sock, urinate on it, and keep it handy. That was the first type of gas protection we had. And the damn nigh killed us.
Why was that? Can you just explain?
The smell and the stink and the idea that you're depending upon that to save you from gas. I can't tell you whether it was proof against the gas or what. But that's what we were told to do. And I look back upon that little episode with shame. But at the same time, I have to acknowledge that I knew then there wasn't any precautions you could take to stop being affected by the gas.
Were you scared of gas? More scared? I mean, was it a fright?
Later on, yes.
But what about when you first got to Ypres and first time in at Hooge? Did you know what had happened and what its effects were?
Well, we went by the weather. If gas made any, what shall I say, movement among the troops as far as their worries were concerned, if the weather was convenient for gas to come over, then it was serious.
So if the wind was from the east, you'd be more worried.
That's right. It was a question of how strong the wind was and where it was coming from. Otherwise, they paid no attention about gas.
Now, what if the wind was from the east? What were there any precautions you could take, or was it just this business about the sock?
Well, I think it was weeks before we got any protection. Must have been months. We carried on with the sock idea until such times as they had a smoke helmet given. And that was a cloth which went over your head, and it was chemicalized. What it was chemicalized with, I never found out. But it protected your face. Then they introduced one with eye holes in, and then they produced one with a mouth aperture in, and it was just a progression of safety precautions.
And what were these early masks like to wear, the gas masks?
Ghastly.
Why?
Well, first of all, they nearly stopped your breath. You had to breathe through the cloth. And it was no use easing the mask up to breathe if there was gas present, you know. You had that smoke, what they call a smoke helmet on, and it more or less muzzled you. And you had to chance breathing outside the helmet. When, of course, we got nose pieces and eyeglasses and this sort of thing, well, it became easy. They could take them out of the cover, put them on, and put them off at your leisure.
But the early gas masks were so difficult to wear that they were almost useless because you had to breathe.
Oh, yes. Yes, that the word useless is the one to use. And everybody realized that, of course. The gas made a profound impression on the morale of the troops. There's no doubt about that.
Were you ever attacked by gas while you were in these early days at Ypres?
I've been lucky twice about gas. We were in the line once when we were relieved at night time.
Where was this at?
I've got to think. Trenches at night time, and he sent the gas over the next morning and nearly killed everybody. Things like that, you know.
That was a cloud gas attack.
A cloud gas attack, yes. And on the other hand,
So you were lucky because you weren't there.
I wasn't there. On the other hand, there was once I managed to get a few people kept safe, and that was a Salvation Army place where they made tea for the troops. And it's just after we'd been to Hooge. And I went into the signaler's office because I'd been doing a message all day and I hadn't been allocated anywhere to sleep. And I knew that the place to go into, if you wanted any word at all, was the signaler's, because they were always awake, you see. And I could interpret what they were saying over the wire. Green gas attack. You know? And as soon as I heard that, I said, my God, this the Salvation Army have a place up the road. I'd better go and tell them. And I up the road and told them. And they were prepared for it when the gas came.
Were you ever in the gas, a cloud gas attack? I mean, did you ever smell it or...
Oh, yes, faintly. Faintly. I've put a gas mask on when the gas has been advised. Then afterwards, you've taken it off and you could still smell the gas a little.
What did it smell like, do you remember?
Oh, vinegary, a peculiar smell. Not obnoxious, but a funny smell.
And did it affect you at all, or was it too diluted?
Oh, no, I was going about with a thing over my mouth all the time and whatnot. Yeah, it didn't get a chance. But otherwise, gas never affected me very much, as far as attacks went, you know.
During the early days?
During the early days.
What, was there any mining under Hooge? From the, you know,
No, strange to say, I can't say no, never. While we were in Hooge, was there any mining went on? And I can detailed umpteen places where mining went on that we were there.